This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
With all that being said, I just want us all to take a collective breath. Breathe out, trolls. Breathe in, inspiration. Breathe out, alternate facts. Breathe in, factual information. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a breath of fresh air, definitely. So besides the myriad pollution and the pollen of blossoms thinking that it's March because of this warm winter, global warming is real, there is something else in the air. I mean, there's a love and appreciation for Gaia, for Mother Nature. There's something in the air as Lab Girl, which is a memoir by a paleobiologist, is one of the bestsellers in the nation. And so we're selling that right there in the back as well. And then over the holiday, we had this other book called The Hidden Life of Trees. And the publisher underestimated the public's desire and appetite for such a book. And it was out of print until recently. Not out of print, nobody could get it. I mean, not even like online stores could get it for a long time. We have that back in stock recently. So there is something definitely in the air. And while loving nature is what we naturally do, while hanging at Rock Creek Park, cherishing the nation's arboretum, which I hope we do because it's a treasure. It's one of my happy places. The blooming cherry trees at the basin, or simply walking through these gorgeous wooded area of this northwest neighborhood of Forest Hills, there's definitely something in the air. Maybe we could call it conservancy. And now with Jill Jones, urban forest, the third note of social justice in today's ethos of environmental literature is beginning to resound. Jill Jones is the founder of the Baltimore Tree Trust. Baltimore's finest is in the house with us tonight. A 501c3 nonprofit organization committed to restoring the city's urban forests and making Baltimore a healthier and more beautiful place to live through increased tree plantings, tree stewardship, community engagement, public education, advocacy, and research. Thankfully, the role of ecology and social justice is nothing new. It's a 360 perspective, a wholeness heard in the continuum that you hear in Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, Mercy, Mercy Me, The Ecology, Inner City Blues, it's all on the same line. And like Marvin Gaye, the span of your work, Ms. Jones, and the written works read like a love song to humanity and our urbane dramas of politics, human nature, and Mother Nature all thrown in together. You can even glean this passion in the dynamic titles of her works, including Hepcats, Narcs, and Pipe Dreams, A History of America's Romance with Illegal Drugs, Empires of Light, Edison, Tesla, and Westinghouse, and The Race to Electrify the World. Fancy. And now Urban Forest, a natural history of trees and people in the American cityscape. Urban Forest is praised in Gardner's December issue as Guy Sternberg notes, Jones dives deeply into trees and their roles in American cities through various eras of history. The text is laced with facts, dates, and figures gleaned from recent scientific studies that rather than making one's eyes glaze over, inspire a profound respect for these resilient trees and the people who champion them. Here to share her expanding meta vision of urban landscapes and its evolving existence with climate change is our shero, Jill Jones.
I think this has to, is this on?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, no one has ever compared me to Marvin Gaye before, so it was, or called me the fabulous Jill Jones, so it's already a unique evening. Anyway, it's really special to be here because as a certain number of you in the audience know, I spent a few years living in Washington, but my parents spent many decades living here, and so I've spent a lot of time in Washington, and it is, of course, the city of trees. And so what I thought I would do tonight in my allotted amount of time is really kind of touch on three aspects of Washington's tree heritage. And I thought I would start with Boss Shepherd. So after the Civil War, Washington had been really planned as a park-like city, and it was quite park-like until the Civil War, when all these bivouacked troops had to cut down all the trees in order to have wood and fuel. So after the Civil War, the trees were pretty much gone, but the city had never really been properly built up. And so there's this wonderful quote when someone suggested that Washington ought to host the 1871 World's Fair. Senator William H. Stewart, and he was rich from litigating Comstock lode claims, said, "Let us have a city before we invite anybody to see it." So, I mean, Washington was in really terrible shape. I'll just read you a description of what it looked like at this time. Few of the main thoroughfares, a few of the main thoroughfares were roughly paved with cobblestones. Otherwise, the side streets were mere dirt roads in which pigs, goats, cattle, and geese roamed unmolested, scattering the little mounds of garbage dumped into the streets by the householders. There was no drainage, there were no sewers, just filthy gutters and a stinking open cesspool called the canal. So Washington looked so bad with no real actual infrastructure that there were growing proposals to actually move the capital elsewhere that would be more worthy of it, including St. Louis. So in response to this, and I'll now read you some sections of my book, at that, Washington's biggest real estate developer, the self-made Alexander Roby Shepherd, roared into action. Like a character out of Dickens, Shepherd had to quit his private school at the age of 12 to become the sole support of his newly widowed mother and six siblings. By his 20s, he was owner of the city's largest plumbing and gas fitting firm and had built 1,500 row homes. A large man, broad of forehead, and with a masculine lantern jaw, Shepherd was, observed a contemporary, quote, "a free liver and a free spender. A man with strong passions and appetites, his large way of doing things was part of the nature of the man. His imperious will recognized not merely no master, but no difficulty that stood in the way of what he wanted to do." On September 4, 1871, President Ulysses S. Grant appointed Shepherd, his longtime Willard Hotel drinking companion, staunch Republican, founder of the local union club, part owner of the Evening Star, director of four streetcar companies, and proud owner of an estate called Bleak House, to the vice presidency of the city's new Board of Public Works. Within weeks, the man, soon known as Boss Shepherd, launched a massive makeover of the city. When Congress reconvened a mere 2 months later, they gazed with wonder at the change in the general topography of the city, at the miles of incomplete sewers, half-graded streets, and half-paved sidewalks. In the next 3 years, Shepherd had just all these work gangs, and they paved 118 miles of streets, 207 miles of sidewalks, constructed 123 miles of sewers, 30 miles of water mains, and 39 miles of gas mains. They filled in this infamous Tiber Canal, the very stinky one. They erected streetlights. They built all kinds of new school. So this was very unnerving to people. They would leave in the morning, and when they would come back, like their stoop, which had been, flat out with the street, suddenly the street would be 6 feet higher. So many odd things happened as Shepherd was actually really creating an infrastructure for the city. And people were, as these sorts of things happened to people, they were besieging Congress saying, you have got to investigate these people because they're just engaged in all kinds of outrages. In any case, where does Shepherd come into this story? So, the overbearing Shepherd did have the redeeming quality of understanding the importance of trees even if he freely confessed his ignorance on the topic. So three people got appointed to what became known as the Parking Commission, and that meant in the terms of turning things into parks, not taking your car. So he remarked to William R. Smith, superintendent of both the U.S. Botanic Garden, which was right at the foot of Capitol Hill, and the new Parking Commission, "Now, Smith, you know I know nothing of tree planting, but I suggest oak trees, if possible, on some streets, but put a tree wherever there is damned room." So for Shepard, who showed a breadth of vision unknown in that day in city improvement work, tree planting was an essential part of the plan. So the other two members of this, what were known as the Tree Troika, was a William Saunders, and like Smith, he was a Scotsman, and they were both trained in their native land and before coming here. So Saunders was a Department of Agriculture employee, and he ran their experimental garden, which was on the Mall. He also actually was really a landscape architect and designed all kinds of private estates, and including in the public realm, most famously for Abraham Lincoln, the Gettysburg Soldiers National Cemetery. And then the final person was a man named John Saul. He was an Irish horticulturalist who also had come and to D.C. to work for Andrew Jackson Downing, which for those of you who know your landscaping would know that he is pretty much the godfather of all things green in America. So what Saul did is he was really a grower, a nurseryman, a grower of trees. So the whole idea was to begin to plant up the streets again. Remember, all those trees had disappeared into the I guess, bonfires and just cooking for the Civil War soldiers. So they were planting 6,000 or 7,000 trees a year, which is a lot. However, you've gotten the idea that Boss Shepard was an all-out kind of guy, and he was all out going through money, and he basically bankrupted the city, and which caused him to be fired. So he lasted about 3 years. He got fired. But meanwhile, it is very true that the city now had an actual physical infrastructure. But the Parking Commission, these three men, they survived, and they were just busy very methodically and very strategically planting trees through these years. So by 1885, so they've now been at this, you know, a little over 10 years, a reporter from the New York Times comes to sort of see all this, and he stands up on the Capitol and is just astonished at what he refers to as the forest city of the nations. And then he's out walking around, and he says, as he's wandering, he says, "Trees all around you, in platoons, in columns, in ranks, single, double, and quadruple, they shade and ornament with their luxuriant foliage not only the most magnificent avenues where fashion takes its daily airing, but equally the squalid and unimproved streets inhabited by the very poor. And one needs only to notice on some hot August day the pedestrians dodging from tree to tree to escape the blistering sun, the horses picking their way where the trees shade the street, and little children continuing their play at noontide beneath their grateful shelter to be convinced that they have an important bearing upon public health and comfort." So a few years later, a reporter for Harper's also came to Washington and was very impressed by what the city was looking like by then. He said, "Wide avenues, smooth as marble, and hundreds of palatial residences, but above all, the city's magnificent trees make it without peer. Such is the effect of the wonderful growth of the street trees seen from the Capitol or other high buildings that it to some extent presents the appearance of a city built in a forest." So a big part of this, aside from the, you know, how beautiful it was, really had to do with public health. No air conditioning, no modern medicine. And it seems that many early presidents died before their time because the area, especially around the White House, was so unhealthful. So one of the tree troika, the commissioners, noticed and observed to this reporter, Malaria, one such a bane to Washington, has been materially checked, and the night temperature during summer that used to be almost unendurable has now been materially lessened. Now the shaded pavement absorbs little heat and the nights are comparatively cool. Today we refer to that as an urban heat island. By this time, the Parking Commission had planted 63,000 trees, and the general feeling was that this really had changed the healthful aspect of the city. So trees were a kind of public health. And again, another reporter, Saunders, said to him, "This city is the pioneer and most successful example of the application of arboriculture to the improvement and ornamentation of public streets." So you have already heard that Shepard, you know, launched all of this and then bankrupted the city. And so he himself kind of fell on hard times. He paid off his debts and went off to Mexico to remake his fortune. And operating as ever in a large way, he departed with, quote, his wife Mary, seven children, a cook, a nanny, seven men, four dogs, and baggage enough to require a private railroad car to San Antonio. From there, the entourage proceeded in two army ambulances. So in 1887, Shepard came back to D.C. for a visit, and he was greeted by this parade honoring him all the way up Pennsylvania Avenue, which for entire 5 miles now had double rows of elms and Carolina poplars, which created this sort of canopy and tunnel of shade. So the citizens were just delighted with this man, despite all of his controversy. And when he came back again in 1895, 6,000 Washingtonians crowded into the Willard Hotel to attend a banquet in his honor. So many of you probably know that there is a very famous, infamous statue of Boss Shepard, and it started off being at Pennsylvania and 14th Street in front of the district building. Then when Marion Barry became mayor, it got consigned to some warehouse, and I'm not quite sure how, but then in it looks like in the 1980s it reappeared, but in some sort of far corner, and it was there for a long time before someone decided that Boss Shepard deserved better and that he should return back to the district building. And I understand since January of 2005, he's back there at Pennsylvania Avenue, 14th Street. Now, I have to admit, I have never seen this statue, but I assume many of you have, and if you haven't, now you know to look for it. So, also, there was mention, as I was introduced, of the National Arboretum. And I also tell that story here. It was created in part by really one of my very, very favorite people in this book, a man named David Fairchild. And he grew up the son of the president of Kansas State College of Agriculture. And he then went east to study plant pathology at Rutgers University. And in July of 1889, he was all of 19 and finished all of his studies, and he was thrilled to join the U.S. Department of Agriculture as an assistant in the Office of Plant Pathology. There he began to make a name for himself investigating, quote, the various rots of the sweet potato. But what he really yearned to study was seaweed. So finally, after about 4 years, he resigned and sailed for the famous laboratory at the Naples Zoological Station. So en route, on the ship, he met this very wealthy San Francisco named Barbara Lathrop, who had been around the world something like 18 times. And Lathrop really believed that America was failing to take advantage of all the fruits and vegetables that were growing in other climates and that really ought to be introduced here as possible new kinds of crops. So he kind of decided, well, here's David Fairchild, and he's already at the USDA. But Fairchild was very committed to his seaweed studies. And so at a certain point, Lathrop reappears in Naples and says, you know, you really have to take up this more practical aspect of plants. And Fairchild says, but what I really want to do is study termites at the Java Garden in Bogor, Indonesia. So Lathrop says, okay, I will fund, you know, underwrite you to do that, but then you really have to get focused on this more practical mission. And so, you know, that all transpires, and Fairchild does return, and when he does come back to the USDA, he persuades them to open an office of plant introduction, of which he is the head. And by now, he is a very handsome man who's also become a great cosmopolitan because he's been all over the world. And he returns to Washington, and several years after he's been here, he marries Marion Bell, who is the wealthy daughter of the inventor Alexander Graham Bell. So Fairchild is not any ordinary bureaucrat, but he is a man of consequence at the USDA and one half of a Washington power couple. And he's a very poetic, just kind of wonderful character, and I should say he played a significant role in the introduction of the Japanese ornamental cherries, but I suspect, you know, people kind of know that. So I thought I would, because this, to me, is such a Washington story, how this arboretum came about. So there was one arboretum in America, and it was up at Harvard, and it was run by the very Boston Brahmin Charles Sprague Sargent. And Fairchild and he would collaborate on things, but Fairchild found him sort of hard to take. So I read you some things that Fairchild wrote. Professor Sargent occasionally came to see me in Washington and generally started the conversation with a facetious remark that he had come to Washington to see what we had in the way of plants. Then I would tell him that he ought to know better, for we had no plants to show him, because we did not have an arboretum, but only people. People, however, who knew a great deal about plants. So now, I just think this is so classic Washington. By 1914, as Fairchild noted, and I'm quoting him, the professional botanists at the USDA resented having the title National Botanical Garden applied to a 10-acre park filled with greenhouses, this is the one at the foot of the Capitol, not associated in any way with the Department of Agriculture or the Smithsonian Institution. Furthermore, we were annoyed that it was under the management of the Committee of the Congressional Library and got its appropriation through that channel. So when the longtime head of that botanical garden, who was Saunders, or Smith, died in 1914, the Department of Agriculture seized the moment to create a National Arboretum Committee. Fairchild was appointed along with USDA scientist Frederick Coville, botanist and breeder of blueberries, Carl Scoville, head of irrigation agriculture, and Walter T. Swingle, a plant explorer specializing in citrus and dates. Soon thereafter, Fairchild was contacted by Frank Brett Noyes, a Washington power player described by one contemporary as, quote, a very remarkable woman, a born leader and a lobbyist, motivated by her pride in her federal city, her long-range point of view, her indomitable spirit, and, this is really the key here, having the influential Washington star in the hollow of her hands, because Janet Noyes, 28, was married to Frank B. Noyes, and he was publisher of the Evening Star, at that time the Capitol's most important newspaper. And this was a woman who had many causes, and all of them got a lot of space in the Evening Star. So in 1914, Fairchild has already sort of launched this thing, and Janet Noyes asks if he will come and speak to some women at her house, which he does. And he felt that when he came home and he, you know, talked to his wife, Mary, and he felt that he'd sort of wasted his time. But he soon changed his mind because he said, from that day, Janet Noyes threw all her energies into the fight for an arboretum and even besieged the White House during two administrations until her husband told her that she would never be invited socially there again. So the Garden Club of America was a new organization, and she was the chairwoman of its Capitol Committee. So during World War I, all this got put aside, but except they did, the USDA, you know, very quietly identified, mapped, and soil tested this proposed site, 367 acres. And then how else do things work in Washington? Well, the war is over, back to the National Arboretum. Not long after Senator Pepper of Philadelphia, brother-in-law to one of the Garden Club's founders, introduced the National Arboretum Bill that December, Catherine Sloan, president of the Garden Club of America, wrote to her second vice president that Mrs. Noyes had hosted a large luncheon where, quote, I pleaded to the wives of the congressmen and senators to help pass the bill. Mrs. Noyes has seen President Coolidge. I think every possible pressure is being used by, at least by, the Mount Hamilton site. So, you know, this is all about sort of who you know, who your brother-in-law is, and, you know, just keeping it up. So she thinks she has it in the bag in 1924, but of course, Washington being what it is, certain House members were still holding the bill up. So at the end of 1926, the Washington Star ran four editorials championing the National Arboretum. In 1927, with the reintroduced bill again before the House and Senate, the Star ran a new article in support of the Arboretum at approximately three-day intervals for over a month and a half. By now, Mrs. Noyes had also rallied to her ranks the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Finally, on March 4, 1927, President Coolidge, and you can sort of imagine, like, all right, signed a bill into law. So that is this, you know, sort of the story that to me is just so typical of Washington, of how this arboretum came into being. And you notice it took 13 years, which I think is also not unusual. So we're going to fast forward to the fall of 1999. In the interim, Washington and its famous tree canopy has really suffered a huge diminution. So Washington was filled with, like most American cities, with wonderful, mature American elms, and Dutch elm disease had been steadily taking those out. All this new urban development, loss of trees to age, and very few new trees planted to replace them, because if anyone sort of remembers, the 60s and 70s and 80s were not easy on American cities. So in the fall of 1999, American Forest, which was the new name, sort of more modern name of the American Forestry Association, which is the oldest conservation organization in the country, had really taken up this new tree science and new technology that allowed you to really assess what was happening with your urban tree canopy. And there was a big, huge front page story that showed the 1997 satellite images of Washington and its tree canopy versus those of 1973. And they graphically revealed a 64% loss of tree canopy in the so-called City of Trees. So on November 16, then D.C. Mayor Anthony A. Williams held a press conference at Pierce Park in Adams Morgan, and he was, you know, showcasing these very powerful images and data to argue for the importance of restoring the city's urban forest. If we can't take care of our trees, says the mayor, how are we going to take care of our schools? How are we going to take care of our roads? Trees are a metaphor of public space. That's what we're fighting for, vital, robust public spaces. So he put up, you know, money to increase the budget, but the reality was that it didn't come close to doing what was going to be required to restore the tree canopy that Washington had long enjoyed. So among those Washington Post readers who saw these satellite images was the philanthropist Betty Brown Casey. Third wife and widow of real estate developer Eugene B. Casey, she was the sole controlling trustee of a very rich foundation named for her late husband. Mrs. Casey approached the Garden Club of America with an initial offer of $1 million to, quote, get started on somehow solving the problem. After long negotiations, the Garden Club agreed on December 6, 2001, to accept $50 million as an endowment to finance the newly created nonprofit Casey Trees. Its mission would be to help restore the Capitol's canopy and its trees to their former lush glory. So in order to, you know, really know what they had, Casey Trees then launched in the summer of 2002 the city's first street tree inventory in decades. We needed to hit the ground running, says Board President Barbara Shea, and make ourselves known. So they sent out, you know, great teams of people. They had Palm Pilots for collection devices. They all had 30 data fields they had to use, and Casey had recruited and trained 38 paid college team leaders, and they had almost 500 volunteers. So, says Shay, we had 30 teams on the street 6 days a week. As you can imagine, the logistics were a challenge, actually a nightmare. Each evening, the interns returned to the office to download their data and recharge units. Fortunately, one of our employees had previously managed a congressional campaign. So on August 14, Casey announces the results of this, and they were really confirmed American Forest, you know, sort of grim 1999 report. One-third of Washington's 136,000 street trees were dead or dying. There were 32,000 empty pits, and D.C. had lost 30,000 of its 38,000 American elms. So there was all kinds of other information. And with the formation of KC Trees, sort of D.C.'s own forestry department, which had been quite moribund, began to come back to life under their pressure. And again, I will then really fast forward up to today, which is what's happened in the years since then with KC Trees. So basically there were 90,000 live city street trees in 1999. In the intervening years between KC Trees and city forestry, that figure is up to 135,000. City forestry has gone from planting 3,500 trees a year to 13,000, three times what it was. Now the canopy percentage is still 35%, but in so many other American cities, that figure has gone down that just to keep it steady, especially with all the development that goes on, that is really a feat. So I'm going to stop there. That's where things are in the city of trees. And I'm just, you know, happy to be here, happy to see a lot of people I know, and happy to take any questions. Thank you.
I have a question. Okay. I'm over here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You're in line. All right. This is we. Okay,
and first of all, I want to thank you because I think, and I probably am not unlike a lot of people, I haven't, until reading your book, really appreciated trees the way they deserve to be appreciated. So I now feel that I do that. And in the last decade or two, we've all become so data-driven. And one of the things I found fascinating was how they quantified the value of trees. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I actually usually do that when I'm, well, I have to say, whenever I'm on the radio and I have a big audience, I always, always, always talk about this new science of trees because it's like news to people. So basically, I mentioned that the first go-round with, you know, what I call the city tree movement, it was really powered by the idea that this was really important for public health. So after World War II, and there was again this, you know, really escalating loss of trees, the world of people who love trees, and that was their life's work, no longer could argue to city managers that they needed trees for air conditioning or they needed them for public health, because we now had air conditioning and modern medicine. And so a man named Rowan Rowntree, who I mean, and I write about this at great length in my book because it's so important. He really concluded, he was a forestry professional and worked for the U.S. Forest Service. He really concluded that there would need to be a completely new science that quantified actually what trees did for you as a city. And that meant, you know, how much did they cool things down? How much air pollution did they absorb? How much stormwater did they mitigate? And just generally, how did they make the city a better place? And how could you quantify that and then turn that into dollars? So I should just say that that is something that they started working on in the late 1980s. They issued their first really sort of foundational report in 1994 in Chicago, because the second Mayor Daley was a really devoted tree person, and he said, don't trees clean the air? And the, well, I mean, in theory, but no one could really answer that in any scientific way. So Rowan Rountree and his two proteges, Greg McPherson, who really works on street trees, and David Nowak, who works on the larger issue of the urban forest, have devoted their careers to this, and there is a software platform called iTree, which is free, public domain, and by entering into that, the data that you need about trees, you can begin, you know, to get these answers. And so when they did this in Chicago, they were really hoping that Daley, who really knew how to get people's attention and make people aware of things, would use this to kind of drive the way trees were planted and cared for and thought about in Chicago. And no one really knows why, but they just paid no attention to this report at all. But the U.S. Forest Service scientists, all of whom are embedded in universities, just continued on because there was a huge amount of additional work that needed to be done. And what eventually happened, I mean, the idea was that this data would drive policy. And finally, in 2005, as Greg McPherson, what he was doing all these years is, obviously, the United States is a very big place, and there are very variety of climate regions. So he was busy getting proper data for each of these climates. So getting proper data, I learned this very late in the game, and I was just so amazed by this, meant cutting down mature trees and counting every single leaf. Weighing every single leaf, doing all these different scientific things to these leaves so they could really accurately assess what these trees were doing when they sort of encountered rain or when the dust came onto them. So the one of the final regions was going to be in the Northeast, and New York City has a very outstanding forestry division. I should say they all went to Yale Forestry School, which now is, I think it's called Yale Environmental School. And they knew Greg McPherson well and his work, and they said, well, why don't you make Queens your city for the Northeast? It'll be your average city. So, fine, they went to Queens. And once they got there, then the forestry people said, well, you know, we've just finished a whole tree inventory that we can plug in to iTree. And so why don't you actually do the street trees? There are 600,000 street trees in New York. Why don't we do it for the whole of New York? You know, and you know, Greg and his partner, Paula Pepper, took a really deep breath because this is going to be a vast amount of additional work. But they also felt like this was an incredible opportunity. Because Michael Bloomberg was mayor, and he was a very data-driven manager. So, in April of 2007, the team was able to deliver a full-scale municipal forest resource analysis. And this is what they could say about these 600,000 street trees, that they annually saved the city $28 million in energy savings, or $47 per tree. Each street tree removed an average of 1.73 pounds of air pollutants for a benefit of $9 or $5 million. But really most important was the stormwater runoff. Those trees collectively reduced stormwater by nearly 900 million gallons, saving the city almost $36 million that would otherwise need to go into making, you know, sort of standard stormwater systems. The average street tree intercepted 1,432 gallons a year of stormwater. And that really made an impression. There are other, so there's a huge amount of, you know, accumulating science and studies, increased property values that come with trees, the increased economic activity. They now know that when you're around trees, cortisol comes down, which means that you're reducing human stress, and stress is sort of the basis of a great deal of human unwell-being. And so all in all, those collective benefits were about $90 a tree. So if you looked at the bottom line of what New York City street trees were delivering annually in benefits, that was $122 million, or about $210 a tree. So the parks and forestry officials got $8 million a year to plant and 10 street trees, and another sort of $6 million to pay personnel. So the net benefit, therefore, was an impressive $100 million. For every dollar that you spend on a New York City street tree, it was generating $5.60 in benefits. The other thing that they learned from his study was just sort of what the dominant trees were, which is also very important because then you can try to avoid that. In any case, when Michael Bloomberg had all this and his, you know, managers had all this presented to them, he quadrupled the city's forestry budget and he launched the Million Trees NYC. So, I mean, you've heard that a typical city that has a very good forestry department is planting 10,000 trees a year, and New York was about to start planting 100,000. And I should say, because the forestry division was worried that when Bloomberg left office that de Blasio would not be so in, they actually finished in 8 years. So New York has just become, surprisingly, like sort of the beau ideal of how to plant 100 million trees. And I have to say that I spent a lot of time reporting on that, and it was so transformative to, you know, see neighborhoods that really did not have trees, and their parks really were pretty scruffy, just how incredibly different they look. So this is really the, you know, the beginning in a big way of this data starting to change the way people think about and manage and strategize over forests. And I mean, essentially today, no urban forester would run their city, if they could avoid it, without having all of this data available to them. So it's just, and at the same time, mapping. So there's a lot of mapping now, and that first started in LA. So LA, you know, announced it too is going to do a million trees, and then they realized, oh, we have no idea where we would even plant them. So they asked Greg McPherson to come in and map where they could plant trees, and what they, and they asked him to do it by councilmanic district, because of course this was going to be a political thing. And what emerged is that trees are markers of affluence. So you could see that Bel Air had a 47% tree canopy and South Central had a 5% tree canopy. And we had the same thing done in Baltimore. And I mean, it lines up wherever you go. I mean, we all know intuitively, if you have a choice of where you're going to plant, where you're going to live, live surrounded by trees. So that's a very, very long answer to that question, because I do think it's incredibly important. And most people are not aware that this science exists. So. All right, sorry about that. Go ahead.
Hi, your information about how to value the benefits of even a single tree kind of leads into my question. We were involved in a battle over a single tree on our street, and it's a situation that I think probably replicates itself in cities around the world, and it involved female ginkgo trees.
Ah.
I'm curious to know if you're familiar with, you know, I think this D.C. has lots of ginkgo trees and about 2,000.
Very early adopter of ginkgo trees.
Is that, I didn't know
that.
So I think about 2,000 female ginkgos, which produce very stinky berries in the fall. So there was a big battle on our street. There was an effort to cut down a beautiful old female ginkgo. And the way the district handles it is if 60% of the residents in a block where a female ginkgo street tree is want to have the tree cut down, it goes to the neighborhood commission, which tends to go with the 60%.
So why don't
vote.
They just spray them? I mean, you know, so all these years my parents lived on Belmont Road, and right around the corner was this street that was huge, mature, beautiful ginkgo trees, all female. The whole street smelled like vomit in the fall, but it was so beautiful. I mean, I don't know that anyone ever, I'm sort of astonished to hear this story from you.
Well, the way D.C., as I understand it, New York City also has many, many female ginkgos, and they smell like vomit for a few weeks, and New York just puts up with it, and there's no way for anyone to bring about their destruction. But in D.C., there is this provision that if 60% of the residents, of the homeowners on the block, sign the petition, then it it's considered for destruction, which ended up happening with our tree.
Oh, so terrible story.
I was just curious if you know how other cities tend to handle it or what you think about this
process. Honestly, I've never heard of such a thing, and I've never heard of a ginkgo tree being cut down because it stinks. I mean, there's endless, you know, discussion and description of all of this. I mean, I assume you know that in Asia, ginkgo fruits are considered delicacies. So I guess there's a part of me that just thinks, like, where is the Asian foraging society that comes out as they...
We actually live around the corner from the Japanese embassy, and there would be folks that would occasionally come and forage.
Right.
And I did try to enlist the support of the Japanese ambassador in our effort, and didn't get
such anywhere. A DC story.
Well, anyway,
I personally think that's really shocking. That, you know, you'd cut down a tree for a bad smell for a month. Ugh, well, what can I say? Yes.
Can you talk about the age, the lifespan of trees? I've read that the average lifespan of a urban tree is like 7 or 8 years.
That is such a myth.
Good.
Such a myth.
please, if you could expand upon that, because I really do think it must make a lot of difference depending on a street tree is not a street tree is not a street tree, and lots of ages, lots of species. So
right. I mean, honestly, I don't know where that came from. That's a very one of those figures that's constantly repeated, mm-hmm. and I, you know, if you had all the time in the world, I guess you could endlessly track it down. And if there might be someone here who knows, is there anyone here who knows where that came from? Okay, if they did, they could answer your question. But I mean, it's, you know, it's very clear that it's simply not true, because we all, I mean, most of us live in cities, and we don't see it, the trees where we've lived come down after 7 years. So I mean, they're are very definitely better and worse trees to plant as street trees. And most cities now have a list of acceptable trees. And they don't include usually things like dogwoods and redbuds, because they aren't very long-lived. So if you have, I mean, almost the best tree you can plant is an oak, just because it lasts so long. And I would say the same thing for a ginkgo. I mean, but they tend to be very slow growing trees. So yeah, no, I mean, this business about 7 years is not true, and the ideal is to try and put up something that will last, you know, 50-100 years. And that all depends again on, you know, a very typical thing with trees is they're planted and they're not properly cared for. You know, they're not watered, they don't have a big enough tree pit and so forth. But give a tree those things, I mean, they've got a fighting chance.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I think he's okay.
Oh, hi. Can you talk a little bit about how a tree physically reduces stormwater runoff? What are the physical characteristics of a tree that make that possible?
Well, I will tell you this. I do not purport to be an expert on trees. I am not an arborist. But this is my understanding, and I think you kind of see it when it rains. Like, if you're standing under a tree, you notice there's lots of rain on the pavement, but there's nothing coming down yet. I mean, it sort of takes a while. So the leaves themselves, and this is why poor Paula Pepper was pulling leaves off of trees for 2 years, the leaves themselves absorb, you know, rainwater. And then the branches and the trunk also absorb rainwater. And then once, you know, they've absorbed whatever they're going to absorb, then it starts to drip down. And I think anyone who's stood under a tree during rain, you've experienced this. It takes a while for the water to start to make its way down through the tree canopy, because it's actually getting absorbed by the tree.
Yeah. Well, my experience is that after it rains, or when the rain has stopped, you can go under a tree and it's still raining.
Well, the water is slow. So then it starts going into the tree roots, and the roots absorb the rain. Now, if you have, like, these really heavy rains we've started to get in recent years, which, you know, were sort of these more ferocious storms, I mean, obviously, you know, a tree will sort of, I guess, max out its ability to absorb rainwater a lot faster, just because, you know, the amount that's coming down is so fast. But the other thing I didn't know about trees, and I should say I knew nothing about trees more than very many people. I mean, I knew what an oak tree was. I knew what a ginkgo tree was. But I did not know that trees actually respirate, you know, these invisible mists up into the air, as, you know, that's just the way they exist. And so they're kind of like air conditioners. It's not just that they're, you know, their leaves are actually shading you. They're actually giving off moisture. And so the air around a tree is cooler than, you know, elsewhere.
Thank you.
So just, it wasn't my question, but also, depending on the tree, but in terms of absorbing water, you know, the whole root system of a tree, you know, keeps the dirt and the earth worked so that it's much more porous in many ways. Just throw that in. But I wasn't listening. Did you mention the difference between native and non-native? Because one of the things I just wanted to say, being a butterfly lover myself, et cetera, and other things that I believe the ginkgo is not native, which doesn't necessarily mean it is not a host tree, but we're losing so many other kinds of wildlife that many trees that would be native, which also usually has an easier time growing and living, also supports whatever the millions of years it had to evolve with other creatures.
Right.
And there's a great place in Baltimore, you know, that blue, it's Blue Water.
Blue Water Baltimore, the Herring Run Nursery, right?
Exactly,
the
and yes, they're
I
one
have
of them.
I have my milkweed plants from there,
right? And they work so hard at making sure that what you're getting is really native. So I go with my, you know, I go and pick up every year stuff from
there. I'm impressed because it's not an easy place to find. It's sort of like down a rutted road in a park.
I know it's in a golf course,
right?
Because
exactly. Herring Run, H-E-R-R-I-N-G,
yeah.
Herring Run Nursery.
And the name has changed, so it's kind of, it goes, you can find it, Herring Run or Blue Water. And
Well, Blue Water Baltimore
and then
is the nonprofit.
All the profits that they get goes back into runoff in Maryland.
Right.
So you feel pretty good.
Yeah. So the whole thing about natives versus non-natives, well, ginkgos are not natives. So the irony is that non-natives actually often make really terrific street trees because they're quite indifferent to all the local pests. I mean, ginkgos are you know, many people love ginkgos, and I love ginkgos in part because they're the oldest living thing there is in terms of trees. They predate the dinosaurs. They've essentially outlived everything that could do anything bad to them. So, unlike many native trees that are susceptible to, you know, ongoing pests, I mean, they really can hold up. Now, do they feed any birds? Do they host any, you know, caterpillars and butterflies? Not really. But sometimes in a city tree, you're just looking for a tree that can survive. So I am not at all a purist when it comes to this question of native versus non-native. So when you're looking at the parks where, you know, trees have a much easier life, fine. Let's just, and I mean, one of the things about oaks is that they do host more creatures and critters and bugs and so forth than almost anything else. So they're, you know, really great in that way. I mean, one of the things I'd like to say about my book is that was so enjoyable about it is that you can imagine, so there's the book is sort of in two parts, which is the first urban tree movement, which is filled with wonderful characters who invented Arbor Day, John Davy, who basically invented arboriculture, and the Davy Tree Expert Company. So one of the things I was very sort of charmed to discover is all of these original people created institutions that go on to this day. So, you know, they're gone, but the institutions are still there. And I should say that Davy Tree hosts the iTree site. So they play a really, really big role in making available and advancing this science as one of the major partners of the U.S. Forest Service. And then in a theme through the whole book is the story of the American elm, which I'm glad to say does have a very happy ending. So, you know, we've had various kind of eco-disasters vis-a-vis trees in America, and the elm tree was certainly one of them, but again, you know, the U.S. government put in decades and decades and decades of work, and it emerges that there are American elms that can survive Dutch elm disease, and so it's elm trees are back in the nursery and are being planted again on city streets. However, I should say very few people know that we are having a very slow-moving extinction of the American ash. So something like 35 states now have the emerald ash borer, and you can inject it, you know, like a big beloved ash, you can inject it and preserve it, but that's not going to happen to the bulk of ash trees. And they're just being wiped out, I mean, literally by the billions. See, this is the great thing when you do a book about cities. That's a problem out in the mountains. So therefore, I have not had to inform myself about it. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm being, you know, kind of flip, but that is another, you know, terrible, in that case, it's a bug just eating its way through trees that used to be not plagued by this because it got so cold the bugs were killed off, and that is no longer true. So I don't know, I have the feeling I'm running out of my time, yes, but I would be happy. Up. My old neighbor, Tom Dunkel. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Jill. I have a question, whether there's a city in the States or internationally that has a particularly poor reputation for preserving its tree canopy.
Oh,
and my other question was, all of us in D.C. have median, a lot of us have median strips in front of our homes where trees have been planted. Are we remiss as people for not watering our trees, or at some point are they self-sustaining and don't need
so
our
usually
help?
When trees are planted, it is the city's job to water them. And they usually, I mean, ideally that happens for 2 years. And the general feeling is after that, you know, the trees...
They're good on their own.
Yeah, they're good. But even, you know, if you have a long drought, then still probably if you want your trees to flourish, yes, you should probably take them a bucket of water.
So. And then how about a bad example city?
Bad examples of cities. Well, you know, honestly, when I did my book, it's sort of so overwhelming, like, you know, as a... historian and journalist like think about this issue. So I would only write about cities or pay attention to cities if they played some important role, like in the advancement and progress, or if something terrible happened there, like, you know, the Asian longhorn beetle. Though I should say Worcester, Massachusetts, which I came to know because it is the front battle line for the Asian longhorn beetle, seemed to have not only terrible tree karma, but very bad care of its trees. So, but honestly, are they worse than many other places? Probably not. You know, I mean, just trees tend to be low on the list of priorities. And honestly, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is, so we're all living in cities by and large. Climate change is upon us. I mean, what can we as ordinary citizens do to make cities cooler? And I mean, there's either green roofs or there's trees. I don't know any other way. So, and one of the things I really came to conclude by the time I finished this book, I no longer sort of think about this as like, oh, we just need to plant many more trees and many more tree pits. I actually think we really need to think about cities in terms of retrofitting them with nature. I mean, if we're all going to live here and we know, I mean, I did not even get into the public health aspect of what we now know about trees and well-being, but it's very, very powerful. Let me just say, trees are essential to us as human beings for our well-being and health. And therefore, if we're going to live in cities, we need to retrofit them with nature. With trees are obviously going to be the most, you know, a prominent aspect of that. But trees really shouldn't just be in a tree pit. They should be in something much bigger. And I think a lot of pavement has to come up and things have to be really rethought sort of to turn cities into places that people can live and, you know, flourish. So, all right, I think I've run
out of time. I have one more question.
Oh, one more question, okay.
I want to thank you for your reading on trees. It certainly has increased my interest on trees. I
Mission accomplished.
Yes, I live in Rockville, and I have a lot of trees around my house, and I really appreciate them. How do you tell if a tree is male or female?
Oh, my God. As I say, I am not a tree expert, and some trees are both male and female in the same tree, and some trees have male trees and female trees. I was also very surprised to learn that. I didn't know that. And I honestly probably can't tell you which trees encompass that. Okay, here's someone who can tell you.
Well, I mean, I just said like a holly tree, there's male and female. And
if you have maple trees. I have maple trees around my house.
I do not know.
The flowers will tell you. Meaning what? To be specific.
Google it.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so I think we're done. All right, thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.